Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Cedar.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
Ever get the feeling you've been cheated?
It is Wednesday, April 13th, 2016. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the four-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, David Dayen. On that huge penalty that Goldman Sachs actually didn't have to pay. And five of the eight most threatening to our economy banks fail the living will tests. What will it mean? I don't know. We'll find out. Almost 40,000 Verizon workers go on strike across the country. Meanwhile, Bernie Sanders receives not only the CWA, the communication workers who are now on strike, their endorsement, but also the transit union in New York endorses Bernie Sanders, and a U.S. senator endorsed him today. Meanwhile, is Donald Trump on the ropes? He's whining like a stuck pig. Will he get the 1237 delegates, or will he fall to the irresistible siren call of Ted Cruz? Meanwhile,
it's literally nauseating. Just even that is nauseating.
Indeed. North Carolina Governor McBigoted pretends to back down off his bigoted, well, it's not just his legislation. Let's face it, North Carolina. Sorry, guys. I mean, I know we got some great Triangle Bill listens to the program. He knows it. There's some backwards-ass bigots there. Meanwhile, clean energy tax credits so that we can change the nature of our power in this country. Killed in the Senate. Elizabeth Warren has a tax proposal that would embarrass even Ted Cruz and Carly Fiorina's tax form the size of a postage stamp. Is that how far she got down? She got down to like a nano stamp. And a fascinating study out yesterday, which shows that not only do the rich live significantly longer than low-income people, but in terms of people who are living in low-income, where you live in the country is incredibly important in terms of your lifespan. And one of the big surprises, New York is one of the best places to live in terms of longevity for people living in poverty. We will get to that. And also, and if Matt Binder is out there listening, or his dad, please, fast food eaters have a higher level of industrial chemicals in their body. I actually think that could be the exclusive chemical that Matt Binder has in his body.
I've been warning him for a long time that his mouth is a graveyard and he needs to stop. But I have a feeling that Matt's okay with that.
His mouth is a graveyard?
Like, his mouth is a conduit for like dead things to eat that he's killing himself with.
Is that what a graveyard is? A conduit to dead things? I guess. I don't know. That
yeah,
was just
in
a
some
weird...
ways it actually is, Sam.
That
yeah,
Tom,
don't get Tom, lost with the light flicker.
That
and
class
the
you're taking with that class you're taking with Thomas Friedman on metaphors is really paying off for you.
If I was taking a Thomas Friedman metaphor class, I would already be writing at the New York Times.
There you go. Ladies and gentlemen, have you ever asked yourself why razors are one of the only products in a drugstore that are locked inside a plexiglass case? Have you ever asked yourself that question? I know I have many times. I just assumed it was because they were lined with gold, and or one of them had like Charlie and the Chocolate Factory type of situation. There was winning tickets in there. Winning. Well, the reason is it's because A, they're small enough to hide in your pocket, I guess, and they're so expensive that dollar for dollar. They are one of the prime choices of being ripped off. But why do they have to be so expensive? You know what? They don't. You know this. I remember the day I got my first Harry's.com razor. They sent it to me. This was a couple of years ago, I think, even now. And it was the nicest razor handle I had ever owned. And it gave me the best shave I had ever gotten. Plus, I was like, I like their shaving cream lotion stuff. I mean, I wasn't a big shaver. I mean, I'm still not a big shaver. And now I actually, you know what I'm using? I know I said I would never do this. And if my father found out, he'd probably, because he gave me this literally 30 years ago. One of those feather things.
Because really?
I use that, yeah.
Huh.
Because I was finding, I had this problem where I would shave, I'd put the shaving cream on, my hands would be wet, and then I have to reach for my glasses so that I can see what I'm doing when I'm shaving.
My
otherwise,
glasses.
I can't.
Hello.
And then my glasses would get shaving cream all over the lenses.
And then it got
and
all
I go
over
through.
My frames, and then my shoes fell off.
I would go through this every time, and I would just be like, God damn it.
Nikki, hello. Where's my social security report? I can't see nothing too good. I'm going to have a big steam in the office later.
That's exactly what would happen. And then I realized I have that feather brush that I had. It's like a horsehair brush, or I don't know what it is. But I had not used it really ever. And then I realized, like, this is what you use it for. So you don't get the stuff all over your hands. So you don't smudge your glasses. So that you can read your social security report in the morning without having to go through a hassle. That's what I do every morning. I go to the breakfast table, and I just have this huge stack of papers. And each day, I go through one page, and then it's like it's sort of like what people do with the Torah. I just time it, and I read the entire report, and then as soon as I'm done, the new report is out. I read one page a day, and it's 365 pages.
And then you do things like,
Harry's.com, it has both the highest quality and the lowest price you can find anywhere. Factory direct prices. They cut out the middleman. It ships right to your door. They sell their blades at half the price of the leading brand. Over 1 million guys have already made the switch. Thousands more switch every day. The starter set is called the Truman. It is a great option for new customers. An amazing deal for $15. Razor handle. Moisturizing shave cream. Three of Harry's five-blade German-engineered razors, plus, because you're a listener of this program, Harry's will give you $5 off your first purchase with the promo code MajorityReport. Go to harrys.com right now. That's harrys.com. Make sure you use the code MajorityReport at checkout to let them know who sent you. Ladies and gentlemen, I should tell you, before we go to David Dayan, I went into a room with Judy Gold. And we were in there for 2 hours with microphones. I went to her. She's got a nice studio up at CBS. It was fancy. And we talked. She interviewed me. We had a fun time. It is out now. It is called Kill Me Now with Judy Gold. And go and check it out. I'll retweet it. You can find it on my feed. One more note. Listen, on Wednesday of next week, I'm going to be en route, or I'm going to be in Vegas and not set up to do a live show. However, what we're planning to do is a very brief recap of the New York primary, and we're going to put it out. We're not going to put it out on our normal feed. Members will, of course, get it, in addition to the talk I had with students in Iraq about a week ago, college students. Members will get that, so don't worry about it if you're a member. But if you're not a member, to get this special episode of the Majority Report, we were going to have nothing on. And then I was like, well, wait a second. I want to recap the primary. We were going to do it for members. But if you want it, you have to sign up and get on our email list if you're not on our email list. Just go to majority.fm, click through to the Majority Report on the Majority Report icon, and then the email sign-up is at the lower left-hand of the page. Sign up for our email blast. We'll send you the email blast. You'll get a token. You'll be able to download this in any way that you normally do on Wednesday at noon or something like that. All right, I'm going to take a quick break. When we come back, David Dayan. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It is always a pleasure to welcome to the program the great David Dayan. He writes in any fine establishment. And that's basically the way you can judge whether or not a magazine or an online site is actually worth anything. If David Dayan regularly appears on their site, then you know it's a quality publication. And even more exciting, we are less than, I think, 3 weeks away from the release of Chain of Title, How Three Ordinary Americans Uncovered Wall Street's Great Foreclosure Fraud. David Dayan, welcome to the program.
Well, thank you, and thank you for that introduction.
Well, it's my pleasure. Now, David, I want to talk to you about two things. One is the Goldman Sachs. As soon as I read that, and I think now at this point, like, when I read the headline, Goldman Sachs settles for whatever it was, $5 point something billion, I immediately, basically because of conversations that we have had, I immediately know this is bull crap. That it is not, that is not, I'm not getting the real story. And my first reaction is I'll just go to David Davin's Tumblr and find out exactly how much of this is real and how much is fake. And here's the metaphor that I've come up with about it. This, just broadly speaking, when you see that a bank has to pay a settlement, it's basically the functional equivalent of me saying to my the members who support this program, I'm going to give you a $5 a month rebate on your memberships in the form of me spending $2.50 per person on a new computer here, which I'm going to credit myself as giving you a $5 rebate.
Right.
Is that basically what it comes down to?
Yeah, it's actually worse than that. It's almost that you say you're going to give a $5 rebate, and then you give it to somebody else. You don't give it to them. You keep their money, but you give the $5 rebate to a middleman, and in this case, the middleman is the U.S. government. So, I mean, we can go through.
Yeah, let's do that.
The entire thing. I mean, so Goldman Sachs was accused of selling these shoddy mortgage securities, basically selling them. They were packed with worthless loans. They didn't tell the investors they were packed with worthless loans, and they sold and marketed them knowingly, knowing that they would fail, and ripped off investors. So that's the basis for the settlement, $5 billion. for investor fraud, for defrauding the people who bought these mortgage securities. So what is composed in this? Well, of the $5 billion, $1.8 billion is in the form of consumer relief. That is two parts. One, reducing mortgage balances for people who are having trouble paying their mortgages, and two, financing affordable housing and some other efforts in low-income communities hard hit by the crisis. Now, say what you will about the merits of any of that. None of that is a penalty on Goldman Sachs per se, because they don't own any of the loans they're going to be cutting the balance on. In fact, the investors who they defrauded are who own those loans. They've sold them in securities to investors and made their money and walked away. So if Goldman Sachs is going to cut loan balances, they are cutting the loan balances that are owned by the investors they defrauded who are paying for that.
Now, how are they cut the balances because they're just basically administering the loans. Is that it? Or, I mean, how do
well,
they?
Well, they're not even administering loans. They created the securitization.
So how do how does Goldman Sachs have the ability to basically say we're going to cram down your principal?
It's a fantastic question, but the answer is that they basically laid out a bunch of securitizations that Goldman Sachs created and said that these loans will be eligible for this loan forgiveness. Now, you know, investors might they might think this is okay because it lets people actually stay in the home and keep paying, be a paying customer, rather than moving the loan into foreclosure, which would end up having to sell the home at a great discount relative to having them continue to pay on a modified basis. But none of that is a penalty for Goldman Sachs.
It doesn't seem to have anything to do with Goldman Sachs.
Exactly.
Well, here's the other question. Why isn't the government doing this in the first place? I mean, if it's not tied into, I mean, this is what we've been talking about for an extended period of time, right? Which is, I mean, since 2008, if the government has the ability to say, we're going to require this set of mortgages, it just so happens that these were ones that were securitized by Goldman Sachs, as opposed to, I don't know, Lehman Brothers or Morgan Stanley or whatever it is, J.P. Morgan. Why can't they just say that? And it has nothing to do with Goldman Sachs. It's just that we're just telling the bondholders or the securities holders, like, you got to take a haircut. They're saying that now, but they're somehow crediting it to Goldman Sachs.
Right. They're somehow crediting it to Goldman Sachs. Even worse than that is the second half of this, which is that Goldman Sachs will finance affordable housing loans. They'll finance the construction of affordable housing. They'll finance loans in low-income areas. Now, all of those things might be laudable goals, but they're also money-making opportunities for banks. The entire purpose of a bank is to make loans and then be able to accrue interest on those loans. As I've said in a couple different occasions, this is like sentencing a bank robber to opening a lemonade stand.
Right.
There is nothing in any way that looks like a penalty in forcing a bank to make loans, which is what they do for a living.
So it's just going to be like your punishment is that you're only going to get like a 2 to 3 or 4 or 5 or 6% return on your money.
Right. So, you know, that entire $1.8 billion, you know, the New York Times had this thing saying, well, they won't actually have to spend $1.8 billion because they get credits for certain pieces of it. And, you know, that was a fine, careful analysis of the settlement documents. But none of it makes any sense because none of this is a penalty on Goldman Sachs. So you throw that $1.8 billion away. You're left with $3.2 billion. Okay, moving on. Now, so $2.6 billion of the $5 billion settlement is tax deductible. The only thing that is not tax deductible is a civil penalty to the United States for breaking the law. The rest of it is seen as an ordinary business expense and is therefore tax deductible.
So in other words, you and I will be paying for that part.
That's right, to the tune of about $900 million, which is roughly, you know, based on a 35% corporate income tax rate, that's the deduction that you can get. So throw that out, and so now you're down to $2.3 billion. But wait, this was conduct that occurred between 2005 and 2007. In other words, a decade ago. And the real value of $2.3 billion today for conduct in in 2005 to 2007 is far less. Not only that, but more important, Goldman Sachs got to hold the profits that they're allegedly giving back to the U.S. government for 10 years. Now, if you look at Goldman Sachs marketing materials, they will tell you that they can make a 10% return on your investment annually, which means in 10 years they'll have doubled the money, which means that they're paying no money for this whatsoever because they got to hold on to and play with illegally gained profits for 10 years before having to, quote-unquote, pay it back to the U.S. government.
And that's not even including the inflation rate, like you said. So $2.3 right. billion dollars 10 years ago is worth, I don't know what it would be today, just in today's
around
dollars.
Around $2 billion even.
Okay, so the idea being here, this is like, yeah, I rob a bank, I get $1 million, and I get 10 years to put that in a bank account, and I'm pulling 30 grand a year or something. Right. Maybe 20 grand.
Not only put it in a bank account, but you're Goldman Sachs. You have to put it in a Goldman Sachs investment account, which is very savvy and knows how to make money.
That is, that's really impressive. So what we get out of this is,
so Goldman Sachs isn't paying anything,
right.
But who is benefiting from this money that is alleged, you know, changing hands here? Not the investors who were actually defrauded. This is supposed to be misconduct because investors were defrauded on these Goldman Sachs mortgage bonds that they were lied to about the quality of the bonds. Does any investor see any kind of compensation, restitution for any of this conduct? No.
Who are the investors? I mean, give us a sense of...
The investors are, they could be union pension funds, they could be institutional investors, big bond companies, they could be bond insurers, they could be sovereign wealth funds out in Norway. There's a multitude of people who bought mortgage-backed securities during
municipalities,
the
housing bubble.
Yeah, states. Municipalities... teachers' funds, a lot of these are ordinary people whose retirement income is tied up in pension funds, and a lot of pension funds bought these mortgage-backed securities. I don't weep necessarily for the investors, but it seems to me that if you are accusing a bank of misconduct and you're saying that they defrauded a very particular group of people, would seem that those group of people should get some kind of restitution if you come up with a $5 billion settlement. But they don't. Homeowners get some of the benefit, and that's fine, but this isn't about homeowners, this particular bit of misconduct. And but shockingly, the biggest recipient, the biggest beneficiary of this settlement award is the U.S. government. It's the Justice Department. They get a big civil penalty. It's like they're just a shakedown artist taking a cut of the profits that Goldman Sachs made off this illegal activity a long time ago.
So where does that money go? I mean, where to the extent
of the U.S. Treasury?
And so in terms of like the cram down on the principal for homeowners, what? How many of those people are still in their homes? I mean, to the extent that you had problems in 2007 or 2008, I mean, what, or is it just that it cuts down on their principal and therefore as their mortgages, I guess, theoretically reset, right?
It will help a number of homeowners. It won't help a lot of homeowners, as we know. You know, when we had another big settlement like this back in 2012, there was supposed to be this amount of money that went to principal reductions. And Sean Donovan, who was the head of the Housing and Urban Development Department at that time, said 1 million people will be saved with principal reductions as a result of this settlement. In reality, when all the numbers came in, it was 83,000, about 90% less than what Donovan said. And this settlement, in terms of the money earmarked for homeowners in this particular settlement, it's an order of magnitude less. It's about 90% less. If 5,000 people are helped by this settlement, I'd be shocked.
So the and you know, it's good that we're helping 5,000 people, but there should have been a lot more. And the real one of the biggest problems is that because Goldman Sachs really at the end of the day pays no price, there's no constraint on future behavior in any way, no disincentive.
Absolutely.
To act that way again in the future.
Absolutely.
And that's the biggest problem with it, isn't it?
And let me say this about homeowners. I mean, you want to talk about it's not a bad thing to help homeowners. We had this big opportunity to help homeowners. And this is part of my book, that there were this situation called foreclosure fraud, where there were millions and millions of fraudulent and forged documents that were sent to courthouses and county registrars across the country to try to prove standing to foreclose, which these mortgage companies, because they screwed up the ownership documents during securitization, could not otherwise prove. And there was a very conscious choice made by people like Eric Schneiderman, the Attorney General of New York, who said, you know what? That is small potatoes. We're going to leave that to one side, even though it's millions of pieces of evidence. There's an easy chain of custody that you can go up the chain and find who was responsible, who authorized the conduct, who directed the conduct. They threw that away. They settled it in something called the National Mortgage Settlement in 2012 for a pittance. And they said, what we're going to do is we're going to use this securitization stuff. That's where the real legal exposure is. That's where we can really help rebalance this thing and help homeowners in a big way. And this Goldman Sachs settlement is part of the result of that. There were five big settlements with all the big banks over their securitization conduct. And the reality is that this idea that you would pass on this one set of misconduct to build this bigger set of settlements for the second conduct did not come to pass. The second settlements have a juicy headline, but no substance behind them. They are completely weak, easily gamed, no penalty on the part of the banks, no real help on the part of homeowners, certainly no help on the part of the people who were actually defrauded, which is the investors, and mostly a payday for law enforcement more than anything else. And that is the true tragedy here, that we took this scandal, the largest consumer fraud in U.S. history, and we threw it away like it was too small of a fish in an ocean, and we decided to go after this other conduct, and we just blew that too.
Yeah, I mean, it wasn't necessarily a mistake, right? I mean, this was this is sort of like another form of extend and pretend, right? We just sort of like draw it out until it just loses its resonance,
its power, loses its emotional force, and everybody only ended up seeing a big headline number, and they figured the banks were, you know, getting some sort of accountability. And needless to say, even though at the time they said, well, we're not discounting, there could be criminal charges that would be filed here. Basically what happens is Schneiderman co-chairs this task force that is supposed to look into this financial crisis era misconduct, and he said that criminal charges were still on the table. To date, in the 4 years since that task force has been created, not one criminal subpoena has even been offered to the banks. over this. So needless to say, no executive saw any dollar of their bonus or their compensation touch, and they never came close to seeing the inside of a jail cell.
Yeah, we have a sound effect, I think, that captures that. There you go. That is the, I mean, yeah. Honestly, as you're telling me all this, that's all like, sorry, guys. What are you going to do? We'll get him next time. We'll get him next time. I promise you, next time.
We got a nice addition of the home game for you.
Right, exactly. Next time, we're going to get him. All right, so it's next time. And now, today, big story. And I asked you before you got on. I was like, you can talk about living wills. And you're like, yeah, of course. And of course you could. I mean, I'm quite convinced I could ask you about any story in the stack I have here today. You could tell me more than I can even read in these pieces. But so the Dodd-Frank calls for the Fed and the FDIC. And they do this separately. And they actually come out sometimes with different results. They examine the living wills, which is basically the plan, what would happen if they had to enter bankruptcy. How will we go about unwinding these businesses in such a way that would not implicate or would mitigate the harm to the broader financial system?
And, which, by the way, I think is the problem, right? I mean, is there another industry where you have to seek help from the institutions in that industry itself for telling the government how they would go about unwinding them if they ever got into trouble? I mean, the problem is that the very need for a living will is an indication that these banks are too big and too unmanageable.
Right. In other words, that's the red flag. Ann Landers' old advice was, if you have to ask if your relationship is over, it's over. And right. If I have to ask, like, how can you unwind without taking down the system? They're too big. You don't. If you have to ask that question, that's an indication that you've got a problem.
And it's further confirmed by the fact that most of these banks can't do it.
Right.
And that's basically what the FDIC and the Federal Reserve found today, is that 5 of the 8 banks that they have studied most recently were unable to give a credible explanation. And by the way, these packages, these living wills, are like 1,000 pages long. You know, these are very intricate, detailed attempts to explain how to unwind these businesses. And they've basically been found to be not credible.
Now, isn't there also, there's also a presumption, I would presume, by regulators that they're getting the whole picture, right? Like that, I mean...
Right, because we are having the institutions themselves create these living wills, and then basically the FDIC and the Fed pass judgment on them.
Right. I mean, the idea, and maybe I'm a little bit cynical, but the idea that... that within a massive sprawling bank like City Group or any of these things, that there aren't divisions saying like, hey, you know what? We're just going to downplay our exposure here because, you know, we got some wiggle room and we can just. And so this is the fact that 5 of them fail this test is sort of like that's the rosiest picture. Right?
Right.
I mean, this is not someone looking at this stuff with jaundiced eyes. It is the rosiest picture.
Let me go one step further. The banks that were studied today that this assessment came out on already put a living will together that was deemed not credible. They got a second bite at the apple to change the living will because the FDIC and the Fed already showed these to be not credible. So they said, look, this isn't credible, try again. And so a bunch of them tried again, and the majority of them, the FDIC and the Fed, said, no, still not yet. these still make no sense, basically, to us.
Aren't they supposed to now, I mean, isn't this supposed to trigger the breaking up of the banks?
That's the very key point. Under Section 165D of Dodd-Frank, if the banks cannot give a credible explanation for how they could unwind themselves, the Fed and the FDIC have a number of options. It starts with increasing capital requirements to make sure we never get to that point, because the banks would have to pay essentially to offset any losses and absorb any losses that they take, so that they would have a less likely chance of having to be unwound. The second step is to divest of certain business lines to shrink the size of the institution. And basically, the Federal Reserve is giving these banks a lot of rope. They've already, the first time they said not credible, try again. This is the second time. Now they're saying you have until October to again send us something that is in any way sensible for how you would be unwound. And after October, the Fed and the FDIC are basically going to have no choice. They're going to have to either raise capital requirements or break up these big institutions. And I would argue that these agencies are giving them too much rope. That if you can't figure this out, this is like years now that we've been going through this process. If they can't figure it out by now, they're not going to be able to figure it out. And we might as well just get on with increasing the stability of the financial system and the security of the U.S. economy by going through the steps that are required in Dodd-Frank to divest these companies of certain business lines and just, shrink the institution so it's actually manageable, so you don't need a will of 1,000 pages or more to figure out whether or not you can even defuse these time bombs.
So part of this, in terms of whether or not the Fed having this authority, is conditioned on what the banks come back with or came back with,
right,
or have come back with. So I mean, just going back to that New York Daily News interview with Bernie Sanders,
sure,
that's what he was talking about, right?
What he was talking about, and to her credit, when Senator Clinton or Secretary Clinton went to the Daily News, she said exactly the same thing. She said you can use Section 121 of Dodd-Frank, which is the FSOC process of the Financial Stability Oversight Council finding that banks represent a severe threat to the economy of the United States. They can choose to break up banks. Or you can use 165D, which is this living will process. And through that, you can force banks to downsize. That was not a crazy insinuation by Senator Sanders. It was, in fact, the law.
Right. All right. Well, I mean, that's typical.
Totally.
Typical answer. I'm just going to go by what the laws are. All right. Well, this is so really the next chapter of this is October, when these banks come back. And I imagine now, right, like what happens? Do you have a sense of, I would imagine these regulators are under a tremendous amount of pressure from various sectors and places within and without our government to say, like, hey, you're being a little bit too a little bit too tough on these living wills. I mean,
there's also an interesting kind of split between the FDIC and the Fed, which have to decide collectively on what to do about this. The FDIC, at least since last year when they first deemed the first batch of living wills not credible, has appeared to be much more willing to play out the implications of that than the Federal Reserve. If this was left just up to the FDIC, my suspicion is we would already see some penalty assessed on these banks that can't seem to figure out how to unwind themselves. The Fed seems much more willing to work with the banks, get them to a place where they can, with some level of credibility, sign off on these living wills. And so the pressure is not just, the institutions on these agencies, but the agencies against one another.
Interesting. And it's not just a question of a penalty, right? It's simply just,
I'm sort of positing unwinding itself as a penalty.
Right.
You know? Yes. But yes, you're right. I mean, that wouldn't be a penalty necessarily. I mean, there's a report that
these guys are very innovative. I mean, they're very innovative.
There's a report that Goldman Sachs put out last year that said that J.P. Morgan would be 25% more profitable if it broke itself up, and profitable in terms of to the shareholders. In fact, there's going to be a vote at the annual meeting of J.P. Morgan Chase to study breaking itself up. the shareholders are going to vote on whether or not it makes sense for J.P. Morgan Chase to break itself up.
I don't want to belabor this.
From a shareholder value kind of perspective, these banks are probably more valuable separately than together.
You know, I mean, that's the, you know, I don't want to belabor this, but, you know, I've had people said, like, you know, this is, it's so simplistic. Banks are bad, says Bernie. And, like, this is the point. The point is not that, I mean, look, I think there's a problem with the financialization of our economy, and it's not right. It's not just coming necessarily from the banks. I mean, it's coming from really the way that I think CEOs and board of directors run their, these side.
Every company has become a financial institution. At
exactly.
Some level.
Yeah, they have these cottage industries where they're basically just betting. You know, their whole way they make money is on side bets, on their company, but. But the bottom line in terms of what is problematic with the banks right now is just simply their size and their relationship to our economy as individual entities is problematic. And you break it up and you've taken off a huge issue off the table. Then you can just sort of judge them like other businesses on some level. But right now, they're basically, there's this sort of like hostage taking that's going on. And it's in some ways, you know, I think this is an indication. It's all just about inertia. Like, it's just really just a sort of about, it's about, you know, egos on some level, right? There's no reason why these banks necessarily need to be this size. It's just like,
right. And I mean, that's kind of how you understand, whether or not people are paying attention. You just ask them, well, what is the positive case for having, banks at this size? What is the rationale for having the top X number of banks control, you know, massive amounts of total assets in the United States? And there is none. I mean, there have been studies.
Volume savings on things like stationery.
No, but those economies, dictionary. The economies of scale, which is trotted out, like, you know, we have to have big institutions,
right,
because that's efficient. That basically peters out, according to studies by Andrew Haldane from the Bank of England, kind of peters out at about 100 billion of assets, which is much, much less than what a J.P. Morgan Chase controls or a Bank of America controls or Wells Fargo controls. So the truth is that there is no real justification for this. And in fact, shareholders would probably be better off if these institutions were downsized, and most certainly the economy would be better off because there would be this sharply reduced downside risk.
David Dayan, author of Chain of Title. You can pre-order this Chain of Title, How Three Ordinary Americans Uncovered Wall Street's Great Foreclosure Fraud. You can order it today online. You can pre-order on, I know Amazon sends you up the rankings, and it's a big part of trying to sell your book. But I imagine it's also available other places.
Yeah, wherever fine books are sold. Powell's, Barnes & Noble, ask your local bookseller.
Demand it. Ask it for your library.
Ask it for it comes out May 17th.
And we will have you on next month for that on that occasion if we can catch you on your massive book tour.
Exactly.
All right, David.
Well,
thank you so much. I appreciate it.
All right. Take care.
Right. I mean, I am quite convinced that I could have said to David, like, hey, incidentally, this new study that came out on longevity, what do you got on that? And I think he could have probably said, oh, well, we actually did some background reading on the Journal of American Medicine.
He's coming out in TNR in about an hour. Right, yeah,
exactly.
Talk about that. No problem.
Yeah, exactly. Oh, I just wrapped up the fifth chapter of that book I wrote on that report that came out yesterday. I interviewed 150 people over the past 24.
He's a machine.
He is. It's insane.
Does he ever rest?
I don't think. I think he might be one of those people who have, like, I mean, I'm not. I did a sitcom that was directed by Robbie Benson. Do you remember Robbie Benson? He was in this like this basketball movie, and he was the guy who played the lead character in The Chosen. People don't remember Robbie Benson. He was like a heartthrob.
No idea who that is.
People my age, he was a heartthrob when we were teens, and
great guy.
He was. There was some basketball movie that he was in. I can't remember. That was really popular.
Hoop Dreams?
No, that was a documentary. But Robbie Benson ended up directing this sitcom that I was in. That was a total disaster. But he had some type of heart condition that kept him from sleeping. I don't remember the details of this.
Is he
it
like
was very
a superhero?
Strange. No, but he only slept like 2 hours a night. Now, if you're like a David Dayton, and I'm not saying he has a heart condition. I mean, David, I don't know how much David sleeps. Then what you do is you get up and you're right, I guess. I don't know. I mean, this is complete speculation on my part. But if you're Robbie Benson, all you do is try and figure out how to direct the show into something that's not funny anymore. And that's what he did. He's just like, maybe if, like, he literally... The show was...
Sam is so committed to the burn. No one has any idea who he is. All right, it's fine, cool. I'll still insult him.
Well, it's not that. I mean, I'm not insulting him. I'm just saying it went awry. It went awry. I mean, if you're not, you know... And because the it was a guy named Lee... Me and this British guy who was in Mousetrap with Nathan Lane. And they thought, like, Mousetrap is going to come out. This guy, Lee... I can't remember his name, is going to be huge. And that means that this show is going to be huge. And I think that like, created all this pressure on everybody. And this guy was very good at physical comedy, but you can't direct somebody to do physical comedy. You can't say, like, try raising your right arm instead of your left arm here or something.
Could you go back to your right arm, Sam?
Exactly. Exactly. It's a...
Robbie Benson's on the cover of Playgirl.
Right now?
No. I looked him up.
Oh, yeah.
That's his notable.
No, he was a very nice guy. He was a very nice guy. And God knows what kind of pressure he was under from the network because they were like, Mousetrap is going to be massive. And it turned out not to be so massive. But I don't know where I... So the point being, Goldman Sachs got away with murder. All right, just a reminder, if you want that special bonus episode that we're going to do on Wednesday for freebies, members are all, you're taken care of. You know, we don't do anything that you don't, I don't do anything that you don't get. I'll start sending you like recordings of, I finally put on, Milo was very upset because Milo calls me sometimes. And she was upset because I took her singing off of my phone, and I put Saul's ringtone on for her. But here is Saul singing, I guess I'm not just giving this exclusively to members, but here's Saul singing Happy Birthday. He would just start belting out Happy Birthday for no reason, but this was a while back. That was it. That's not that exciting, but that's the kind of bonus content you get if you're a member, even though everybody gets it. Become a member today. Become a member today by going to jointhemajorityreport.com. Jointhemajorityreport.com. Just nickels a day. Not even nickels. Yes, nickels. But let's put it this way. 50-cent pieces? No, that would be too much. We would have to give you change if all you had was 50-cent pieces and wanted to pay it that way for your membership. We would have to give you change. So it costs you nickels a day. And if you want that bonus episode next Wednesday, it's going to be a down and dirty episode. I don't know if there's going to be any. Well, I'm not saying it's going to be pornographic. Don't look at me that way. I'm just saying, like, I don't think we're going to have an intro.
Looking at you that way.
Well, you had this look on your face.
Odd projection there, Sam.
Well, what was that face for?
It was still like a down and dirty. What does that mean? But that doesn't mean porno. Well, I mean, that's a little bit of a jump, buddy.
It's going to be, it may be Cliff and I talking about the primary to that music in the background that Matt just played. But if you want it, regardless of what it turns out to be, you got to sign up for our email blast, because we're now doing legit email like content in there and stuff.
If you wonder about the great music that I play on the show, you're going to want to sign up for that email blast.
Matt's playlist is in there.
It's like, even though you wrote the email, you're sketching on the details. The email has Sam's wrap up for the week and some of the things that he's read that led him to his highly illuminated opinions on the show.
Yes, and things that sometimes I don't get to on the show
right.
that I found interesting. So, all right, I'm going to take a quick break. When we head into the fun half, 646-257 is 257-3920 is the number. 646-257-3920 is the number. We'll take your phone calls. We will also take your IMs. We got some fun stuff. What do we got today? A weird thing with Podesta. I mean, it has nothing to do with the campaign, but I knew this about Podesta, but it sort of came up. He certainly projects that he has seen information about the potential for alien life on another planet. What? What are you talking about? Well, stick around, and we will get to that.
You think maybe it's David Dayen?
That Dayen is actually... That could be pretty.
Oh, I already wrote an expose on Area 51.
No, the point being that maybe that explains Dayen's ability to do all this work.
Right.
Could be maybe he's even from the future and he already knows all this stuff. And he's sort of like.
Aliens are just like benign future progressive pundits.
That's right.
It's a very nice vision.
All right.
We're here to clarify fiscal policy in a compassionate and rational way.
And we'll play that Rick Scott PAC ad. We've got a bunch of different sound. We're going to take a quick break. Head back. We'll be right back with the fun half.